Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me, they call him the Teeth Rattler. At least that's what Pam Grier says, Mr. Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
I am rattling teeth, my friend. That's how I'm doing. How you doing?
Only Mrs. Rose knows for sure. Well, her and maybe Pam Grier. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture, music. Hell, we break kayfabe on everything, Barry. And on this show, we're going to be looking at a couple matches from Houston. One that was mentioned to us by our friend Kevin Orcutt quite a few times, I'll say, Barry. But we're going to talk about that. We're going to do a top five comfort foods, Barry. I think you and I are ready to talk about some comfort foods. What do you think, my friend?
You know what? I could talk about food 24/7, so I am very excited about talking about comfort foods. Absolutely.
And since we are recording this a little bit out of sequence, at the time this comes out, my daughter will already be married, my little girl. She doesn't have my last name anymore. But I'm going to try to be fine with that, Barry. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go. Let's do it.
Okay. Before we get going on the show today, Barry, we had another bit of sad news as you posted a couple days past of this recording. That, in fact, our upcoming CWF Legends dinner and get-together in Lutz, Florida is, in fact, going to be the grand finale. Why don't you take the lead on that and tell us about that news?
Yeah, so it is. It's one of those bittersweet moments. And I'll say it's bitter because I guess technically in my heart I don't want them to end. It's sweet because it is ending, and it is, my life is as everybody's lives are, is stretched extremely thin. So we do record our podcast. We record once to twice per week, but you and I do a fair amount of research. I've been researching the history of championship wrestling from Florida for years, and I devote hours weekly to do that. I do have a full-time job. I have a family that I like to see once in a while, but my plate is full, and my plate is probably three times full. And with the CWF Legends Fan Fest, I absolutely love it. And you know, we've talked about this before, but my favorite thing is hanging out. It's whether we go out to dinner at night. And that last dinner we went to, Jeff, at Portillo's in Tampa, there was like 30 of us at the table, maybe more, maybe less, but it was right around 30. That was so much fun. And that really is the key for me. It's cool to meet all the wrestlers. And it's, you know, for me, I'm a souvenir guy. So to be able to get autographs and photos, and even though I run this event, look, I'll be the first one to say I'm technically the biggest mark there because I'm getting photos, I'm getting autographs. It's a big deal, but we did make the decision, and part of it was we did four events in 28 months, and when you do four events in 28 months, something's got to give, and we've watched our attendance. And you know, look, we were never absolutely huge. We had 140 people at the first one. I think it was 128 at the second one, and the third one we were down to about 82 people. So that's a drop off, and it certainly wasn't for a lack of talent, because if you look at the names we have, you know, whether it was Roop or Kern or the Assassin, you know, Bugsy McGraw, who is returning for this one, you know, we had J.J. Dillon, we had Kevin Sullivan, we had some really, really good talent there. And our fan fest is different, and maybe this is where I accept the responsibility on the promotion side, that maybe I didn't emphasize enough that this is not your typical fan fest. This is not, you know, where you pay $30 to meet somebody and then stand in line for 45 minutes for a 30-second meet and greet. This is, you pay one fee, you come in, and you can talk to these guys as long as you want to. So maybe I didn't promote that enough, but I do feel that four events in 28 months, I'm sorry, I keep saying 28 months. I'm 100% wrong. It's, I've been saying that all week, actually. It's four events in 16 months. So just to give you an idea, and maybe that was it, maybe it was too much, but we decided to take a break. Is it the final one? You know, it probably is in this incarnation, the way that we know it right now. But, you know, we certainly could return, or at least I could return in another form going forward. And I would just give it a little bit of time. You know, I know that we initially had talked about next summer, with Barry Windham, who was on board. And then Kendo Nagasaki is actually going to be in the United States next August. So that was something Bruce Tharp reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested? And, you know, it's Kendo Nagasaki. That doesn't happen every day. So it's possible. So to that end, I encourage you, when Dave Penzer made the announcement that this would be our last, at least for a while, it did spur on a few actual ticket buyers. So I'm certainly grateful about that. But I encourage you, if you're listening, if you can attend, it's not a fan fest. I've heard it referred to as a family reunion. It's a get together. And just the cool thing is you've got some real wrestling legends, Jerry Briscoe, Pat Patterson, Ron and Robert Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, the man with an amazing podcast, the Studcast, will be there. Bugsy McGraw and Leilani Kai. And I got to admit, I'm really excited that Leilani Kai is there because being a collector, I have one of my prize jewels is an autographed copy. It's got 26 autographs on it of wrestlers who were there from the Super Bowl of Wrestling, and Leilani Kai was at the Super Bowl of Wrestling. So I get to add that, which to me is it's priceless. So I'm real excited about that. We get to hang out. Hopefully we can actually record something while we're down there as well. And you know, instead of just recapping it, maybe we can actually record something while we're there. So is this it? Yeah, this is it. But at the same time, what a way to go out. And I want to encourage you, if you're within driving distance, you know, Travis Reigns is coming from North Carolina. Aaron Grafton is coming from Chicago by way of Arkansas. And that's a real commitment. Bruce Cohen coming from New York. Once again, Bruce has been at two of the three and actually was supposed to be at the last one and couldn't make it. But, you know, Jim Clark is coming from Atlanta. So we have people coming, you know, from all over the place. But I encourage you, if you're able to make it, it is November the 3rd in the Tampa suburb of, is it Lutz or is it Lutz?
Well, okay. Did you finish with your piece? Cause now I got to say a piece.
I think I am. I think.
Okay. So yeah, you talked about guys like Aaron Grafton, who we've never mentioned before on the show. We probably should have, cause he's a very loyal, person on our Facebook page and a listener, and we mentioned Travis Rangin. And look, folks, we know that people that we mention, like Greenbaum and Chris Zaha, guys that are coming from different parts of the country, would love to be there. And you know what? That they can't make it, I got no problem with that. I got no problem with a guy, you know, from Virginia or Chicago that can't make it down to Tampa, Florida. You know what I do have a fucking problem with? I have someone that I know that lives in the Tampa area that can't make it. Oh, I can't make it. Or, hey, can you give me a perk fucking ticket? How about dipping into your wallet, you tight ass, and paying some money to see people like Ron and Robert Fuller and Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe? We're not talking hot garbage here, folks. We're talking legit Hall of Famers. Spend a little fucking money and don't be what someone once said to me, which is that wrestling fans don't spend money. That's what I had someone in the industry tell me one time. So prove us wrong. Dip into your fucking wallet and come see these legends, because it's the last chance you fucking get. And whether any of you people out there listening know it or not that are planning on coming to this event, the guy carrying the fucking water on this lives in the Philadelphia area. And he's carrying the water all the way from Philadelphia down to Tampa. So why don't you help a brother out, support the cause, and come see the CWF legends. That round of applause is for you, Barry.
That was passionate, Jeff. And I would be said water boy, just like Adam Sandler. I would be the guy.
Bobby Boucher.
Yeah, Bobby Boucher. You're 100% right, and I'll relay this as well. So one of my biggest frustrations is that, again, as you said, the big cuddly Aaron Grafton is coming down from Chicago. John Doe, Bruce Cohen. These are people who are flying, that are driving, you know, that are stopping on the way. There's expenses involved. And, you know, we can't get people that live within 30 minutes of the event to come. And look, you can get in for $15 if you want to come in and meet the guys and shake their hands for $15. So that is a frustration. And as you mentioned about people, and I'm not going to, but I had three people over the last week reach out to me looking for free tickets. I should clearly state that none of these people were people that I'm friendly with. I'm friendly on Facebook, but these aren't people I'm, and that's, I've had zero, almost zero interaction with these people. So it's not like somebody that I message or we comment on each other's posts. These are people who just said, hey, I'd like to come. Do you think I can get free tickets? And that's highly insulting. And it's highly insulting, first off, because we have to pay appearance fees. And guys like Pat Patterson, they don't come cheap. You know, Kevin Sullivan, we had to fly from Washington State, a remote island in Washington State. Then we have to pay an appearance fee. Then we have to pay for the hotel. So when you start to add up the trans, when you start to add up appearance fees, hotels, there's a lot of expensing involved with this. And the fact that people would ask for free tickets, and look, it's one thing if you're a good friend of mine and maybe there's a financial issue, and I'll be the first to tell you, I do have a good friend that has gone through financial problems that is my guest there. You know, absolutely is my guest there. But if I don't know you and you reach out, that means you've got balls the size of fucking King Kong's balls.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, someone who does not have balls the size of King Kong is Ian Totten, our friend who has written The House of Silver Doors. You know why? Because unlike some wrestling fans, not people that live, of course, in the Tampa fucking area, Ian has put his money where his mouth is because Ian has jumped on board again as a sponsor of this fine podcast. So round of applause for Ian. Thank you very much. House of the, there they go again, The House of Silver Doors. Sorry about that, Ian. So I want to encourage everyone to check out Ian's book. It's available on Amazon. Give it a look-see. It's a Stephen King type of Peter Straub maybe kind of book in the vein of It, Salem's Lot, that kind of stuff. And I would encourage you, I'm sure Barry also would speak up and say he encouraged you. He's sponsoring our podcast. Spend a little do-re-mi on Ian Totten's book, the House of Silver Doors. There, Barry, I'm done because I'm kind of pissed off about these people that don't want to fork out any fucking cash.
Yeah, well, it is funny. Look, wrestling fans, there is a reputation there that wrestling fans don't like to spend money. The irony is there is a segment of the population that spends $100 to go see the WWE. When you know, a lot of these tickets are really expensive in these big arenas, and then you get the T-shirt. And I think that is more parents with kids. But, you know, not to say, by the way, that was maybe the best segue I have ever heard about the large balls. And, Ian, I'm not sure, you know, what's going on down there, if your balls are absolutely huge. But I would imagine they would have to be, because when you write a book that is as interesting, and the book is ballsy, Jeff. You know, from what I've seen, I got to admit, I have not read the entire book, but I've read some of the book. It is a ballsy, ballsy book. And my appreciation as well to our listeners. We have the most passionate group of listeners. They're astounding. But at the same time, they've really supported Ian's book. They've been buying it. Ian has reached out to both of us as well as our producer, the great Brian Last, and said how happy and how pleased he was that our group has really embraced his book. So we encourage you, look, it doesn't cost an arm and a leg to get a copy of this book. At the same time, it keeps us running. It keeps us, you know, being able to show up every week. And I'm real excited, Jeff, because, you know, when you get something, in my opinion, too, from what I've seen of Ian's book, when you get something, that type of literature, as strong as it is, and he's willing to come into our world, which, let's be honest, our Facebook group can be really unusual, that really says a lot. So I'm real excited about that.
Yes. And so we thank Ian for supporting us. Yeah, we thank all the people on, as we call our Facebook page, the Brothership, for supporting Ian and his work. And we hope that Ian will continue writing and continue producing these interesting novels. So now, Barry, I feel the need. I warned the great Brian Last for this one. Barry, I'm going to lay a story on you that you don't know about of what happened to me yesterday. So, Barry, I'm getting in my car, preparing to go to work, and I live in a development in Northwest Broward County, okay? And so I'm leaving. I'm slowly sort of making my way out of the development, waiting for the gate to open up. Now, in my driveway, I have one of these trees that has kind of the large berries that usually their purpose is to stain your car so that you've got to take it to the car wash once a week. But these particular berries, sometimes they fall on the windshield, and when you go to use your wiper, they get flung off. So as I'm driving, slowly making a curve, I hear something rattle through my engine. And I'm thinking to myself, it's one of those fucking berries. And so the gate is opening. I go to press the rear defog because, you know, unlike the rest of the fucking company, the country, we still got 85 degree temperatures here. So I got the defrost or the defog I need to use on the rear window to get the condensation off. And so I'm going and I take off. I'm heading towards the expressway and I'm noticing that my air is blowing a little bit warm. And I'm like, ah, shit, I must have, you know, I'm in Florida here, Barry. We need the air conditioning. And so God bless Mr. Carrier, the inventor of the air conditioner. So I'm going, ah, shit, I pushed the wrong, you know, have you ever done that, Barry? You push the wrong button and all of a sudden you get the, you know, the defrost instead of the air conditioner or something like that. And so I'm going, what the hell is going on with my air conditioning? And for some reason, my damn defog or in the back mirror is not, or the back window is not working. Like, what the hell is going on? So I get on the expressway. I'm riding on the expressway. And guess what I see, Barry? Yeah, Mr. Battery Light has suddenly come on.
Oh,
that's not a good sign when you're on the fucking expressway. So I'm like,
no.
I don't want to take this thing all the way into downtown Lauderdale, park in the parking garage at work, and then come 5 o'clock, find my car is dead, and I got to go all the way back out to Northwest Broward, which is a good 40, 45 minute hike. Oh. So I'm like, let me take it to my mechanic. Well, my mechanic doesn't open until 8:30. So now I'm like, it's a little bit after 7. I got to go to the dealership. So I take my car, I'm going over to the dealership. Luckily, you know, because it's a Wednesday, there's not much going on in the old service bay at a dealership on a Wednesday morning at 7. So I go in there and I said, oh my God, thank God for the blessed air conditioning. Cause you know, at this point I had to roll down the windows. And so I get there and the guy says, well, you don't have an air conditioner. That's a bad sign. Tell me what's going on. So I give him the description. I, you know, tell him, and he says, oh, he says, let's go out and take it. We pop the hood. Guy looks at my car and he says, oh, there's your problem right there. I said, what? He goes, hey, your alternator belt. You threw your alternator belt. He goes, I got to tell you something. Anytime your battery light comes on in your car, it's never your battery. It's your alternator. That's a little bit of quality intel for the listener there. So wow. I'm like, oh, okay. So what, we got to put a belt on there? Yeah, you know, if you threw a belt, a lot of times that's covered under the old warranty. You know, remember those warranties you pay for when you buy a car, Barry? Those warranties you never seem to end up using. Anyway, so he says, oh, let me go slap it. We'll take a look at it. I'll slap a belt on there. And if it's what I think it is, you know, if you threw it like while you're on the expressway, and it's probably covered. I said, well, you know, it's funny. I was leaving the house and I thought I heard was a berry dropping through my engine block. And he goes, oh, that's a little strange. If you threw the belt while you were still in your neighborhood, that'd be a little unusual. So he leaves me with that. So then I go into the little cafe area where they have the coffee and donuts. I do not partake in the donuts because, you know, I'm watching my girlish figure. And so about half an hour later, meanwhile, I'm making the calls and the texts to my boss. I'm going to be probably about an hour late because I got court. And the guy comes in about a half hour later. And says, yeah, we found the problem. I said, okay, what's the deal? Your problem was you had a rat there in your engine block. I said, what? Yeah. You had a rat or a mouse. Because yeah, God knows, Barry, I live like 100 yards from the fucking Everglades. Okay. And so he goes, yeah, you had a little rat there in your engine block. He somehow got on the belt and, yeah, that's how the belt ended up getting thrown. So, and then he utters these immortal words. We need to clean your engine block. So there, Barry, let's all get a visual of what my car engine must have looked like at that point. So then he says, yeah, we'll just slap the belt on and, you know, get you on your way after we clean the engine block. I'm like, oh, okay, you know what? Do you want us to rent you a car? No, because now, of course, he's also told me because of old Mickey there, it's now not covered as part of the warranty. What a huge surprise. So now I'm like, okay, what's the damage going to be? So he tells me how much it's going to cost. And I sit back, I'm waiting and waiting. Oh, let me see if this guy can get me out of here. I can still get to work and get some work done. And he comes back in about a half an hour later. Now, mind you, I'm at a Kia dealership, okay? And I drive a Kia. So, you know, it's not like I go to my regular mechanic who maybe doesn't see a Kia every single day, right? No, I'm at the Kia dealership. Yeah, we don't have that alternator belt. So we got to get somebody to bring it into us. You're a fucking Kia dealership. What do you mean you don't have the belt?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Now they have to wait for the auto parts store or another Kia dealership to bring it. I said, how much time am I looking there? 30, maybe 45 minutes. I'm like, just give me the fucking shuttle and let me go home. So they give me a shuttle. Very nice guy. Takes me on the shuttle home. And I'm like, what time you guys close? We're here at 7. So I'm figuring the wife will get home and I'll pick up the car. And that's exactly what happened. I picked up the car. Everything's working fine. Other than the fact that I had to write sign the receipt there, which was kind of a bummer with the price I was paying. But so I get home. Air conditioning is working fine. Everything's good. So you think that's the end of the story, right? No.
Yeah, that's it. No.
Nope. We have a, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. The rest of the story is, Barry, that I'm walking my dogs last night about 10 o'clock, take them out, and I'm going to have them go by the old front yard. And this has never happened before. That's why I noticed it. So my one dog, my beloved Gunny, pulls the leash over towards my front grill of my car because I had backed in. And Gunny starts doing the old sniff test on the front of the grill. And I'm like thinking to myself, what the fuck is Gunny smelling in that engine block that he's never apparently smelled before? It's probably a little bit of mouse guts residue or something. And you know what? Something, but somebody told me, very interesting, Barry. I'm like, why the hell? You know, it's not like 40 degrees here. Why is the little bastard hiding in my engine block? Someone told me, and I don't know if this is true or not. I have to check with my boy, Travis Range, the official mechanic of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, by the way, because Travis gave me some good intel on what they were doing with me there at the old auto shop. But apparently the wires are coated with some sort of soy, and that's when you get a squirrel in your engine block. As Travis said, this is not completely unusual. I've heard about people getting critters in their engine. Is they coat some of the wires with some sort of soy substance, so when they're eating the wires, they're not eating your wires because they're hungry for electrical wire. They're eating it to get the taste of the soy. Sons of bitches. So that was my day.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was my lovely day. The rat in the engine block. Maybe it'll be a new character on the 605 podcast. Who knows? So, Barry, want to mention a great movie that I had a chance to watch yesterday during my day off, as it correlates to an episode that we had done previously. Previously, we had talked about unsolved mysteries that we found sort of interesting, Barry. I don't even remember how many episodes ago. It's been a while, though. Very well-received episode. We discussed the death of Bob Crane, the former star of Hogan's Heroes. So, Barry, I reached out to you and said, have you ever seen the movie Autofocus? And, Barry, what did you tell me?
Absolutely, I have.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And just a great movie starring Greg Kinnear and Willem Dafoe. And it's got a lot of really good cameos from people. You're like, holy shit. Like, I was watching his wife. Oh, that's Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks' wife. And there's Ed Begley Jr. has like literally like this walk-on part. But there's like these people that are pretty well-acknowledged actors that have these relatively minor roles. And it looks at the life of Bob Crane and his slow descent into obsession, if you will. Bob Crane was obsessed with photography and, more importantly, with taking pictures of women nude and videotaping them. He meets this man whose name is John Carpenter, not to be confused with the famous director of Halloween. But wow, Barry, what a friggin' movie this was. Just absolutely crazy watching Bob Crane's slow descent and slow spiral downward.
Yeah, it catches you off guard almost as well. I started watching it, and the movie's been out for years, and right around the same time that we were doing that episode, which is probably 6 to 8 months ago at this point, it was airing on cable, and it's Autofocus. It was on one of the pay channels, so it was on frequently. It was on literally almost every day. So I sat down one afternoon and I started watching it, and it's kind of riveting. It's Willem Dafoe, I just think, is he's mesmerizing, as he is in a lot of his roles. Really, really good. But Kinnear did a good job as well. The story is good. And when the movie, I remember after I watched the movie, I went online to see what was being said. And there was some things they said that, well, you know, the director took liberties with this. And I think it was Bob Crane's son who wrote the book that said, nah, you weren't seeing the real story. But, really interesting and really, I mean, I guess a guy that we could say, considering now that you see people going into rehab for porn addiction and sex addiction, Bob Crane, it's safe to say he had some sort of addiction to pornography before really the explosion of it. He was kind of right there on the cusp of it. So it's a good movie. It's definitely a movie I would watch. It's I would recommend it. Kinnear is and Kinnear's a guy to me that's kind of fallen by the wayside. Like, I don't know what, you know, there was a period where I think he was nominated for an Academy Award and he was everywhere and he was the hot thing. And I don't know what he's even doing now. Like, I haven't heard anything about him.
He made Autofocus. He made the movie with Jack Nicholson, I believe. Right. It's called As Good As It Gets. And he also made a movie that I love called Stuck on You with Matt Damon. It's a Farrelly Brothers movie that I really like. That's a Farrelly Brothers movie a lot of people don't talk about. But, so Autofocus, if you get a chance, folks, definitely worth a mention and definitely worth checking out. It's definitely something different. You probably don't want to watch it with the kids. That's all I'm going to say, because there's some pretty troubling stuff in there. And it's a very accurate description there, Barry, when you talk about his addiction. The way some people are addicted to drugs, he was addicted to sex and pornography. And wow, it's just very, very, very troubling. But speaking of the Bob Crane episode that we did with the Unsolved Mysteries, Barry, we have a special announcement for the good listeners. They have been asking for it. They have been waiting for it. I am happy to announce that upcoming within the next few weeks, because let's be honest, Barry, we got a couple of the next couple of weeks are going to be a little bit hectic for both of us. I have a wedding that I'll be attending. I believe Mr. Rose will be attending it in the greater Atlanta area. Yes, we will be breaking kayfabe on life and marriage. Wow. And then after that, of course, we have the CWF Legends event in Tampa. So recording's going to be a little hectic for the next couple of weeks. But after all those events are done, it is Unsolved Mysteries Part 2 here on Breaking Kayfabe. I have been doing some initial research, and we got an old Bob Crane thing last night. And I'm saying, Barry, it's time to do Unsolved Mysteries Part 2. Barry, given the couple of weeks to prep for it, are you ready for Part 2?
Well, yeah, given a couple of weeks to prep for it, I'm absolutely ready. if you said right now, no, I'm nowhere near ready. But let's touch on the wedding, Jeff. We are, from this airing of this show, we're literally, I think, just 4 days away at this point. So I want to warn you, and I don't want all the attention to be on me at the wedding, Jeff, but I am known to break down in tears and cry my eyes out at weddings. Would that be all right if I do that?
Well, all I got to say is based on some stuff that I have planned for the event, my wife, I think. I posted a picture on my main page on Facebook of the amount of Kleenex that my wife has purchased for the ladies at the event. And someone told me when I told them of my plans, they said, tell your daughter to wear waterproof mascara or no mascara at all, because, we just got some special stuff planned for my daughter, Kelly. So get ready for that. So, anyway, next, moving along, Barry. What do you know what time it is?
Oh, what, I'm looking at my – oh, my God. It is time for America's Favorite Game Show. Once again, coming to you live, Jeff, it is
– Florida Man or Not. And this episode, by the way, this game show that America loves, not hosted by Wink Martindale. No, not hosted by Alan Ludden. This edition will be hosted by Barry Rose, the man they call the Teeth Rattler.
The Teeth Rattler. This is my week, Jeff, to bring up five stories. So out of curiosity, were you in the Facebook group today when one of these stories got spoiled? Did you happen to see that? I'm going to say you didn't.
Give me the headline, and I'll tell you. I called him out.
So Josh Greenbaum posted a story today, and I came back and I said, motherfucker, I said, now I have to go back and find a new story. All right, so it's about the squirrel brain, so you did see it. Damn it. Yes. So anyways, I did go in. So I was going to come up with the squirrel. Would you have said squirrel brains caused a man's death, Florida or not Florida? It happened in New York, by the way, but what do you think? Would I have gotten you with that one or no?
You might have, because that definitely sounds like something that could have happened.
So who knew? Who knew if you ate squirrel, you could die? Jesus.
They're such friendly little bastards.
Yeah, you ready for story number one?
I'm ready. Go ahead.
All right, absolutely. Complaints from visitors about being pushed onto a mattress where actors simulated raping them at a very edgy haunted house has led to the suspension of the actors involved. A local newspaper reports that Fright Fest owner Jeremy Caudill, no relation to Bob Caudill, says that he was shocked and appalled when he learned Monday what had happened over the weekend at his haunted house. Some visitors complained to the newspaper they were injured by actors who shoved them. Two customers said they were pushed onto a mattress where actors simulated rape. Caudill says he's still determining what happened and promises additional security and monitoring going forward. Fright Fest is advertised as a hands-on experience with actors getting physical and swearing amid risque scenes. Now, I'm a huge haunted house guy, so for me, I guess the simulated rape's not something I want to see, but I do love these haunted houses, Jeff. In any case, did this take place in Florida or not?
Well, let me think. First of all, I am completely not into the haunted house thing. I just would never have gotten into that at all. That being said, my daughter every single year goes down to a Universal for the whatever the thing is down there. What do they call it?
Halloween Horror Nights.
Halloween Horror Nights. Yeah, thank you. She and her fiance, soon to be husband, they always make a trip down there with their friends that live in the area. And they, unlike some people that go to the CWF Legends that live in that area, they pay to go to Halloween Horror. Oh, there you go. I threw a little shot out there. So now let's take a look at. We got the Halloween. It was a Fright Fest, so it's not something from the Universal Studios there.
I can clearly tell you, having worked for Universal Studios, and you and I have
there's no mock rapes going on at
there's
Universal.
There's no mock raping happening at Universal Studios. So yes, but this is Fright Fest, and that is it's good. And but yeah.
And within today's, today's world with the Me Too unit, the Me Too movement, I haven't heard anything about this. I'm going to say not Florida, because I think that would have been a big story here in Florida if it had happened here in Florida at one of the places.
You're absolutely correct, Jeff. It happened in Akron, Ohio. So in Akron, Ohio, the actors at these haunted houses will push you onto mattresses and simulate raping you. Somehow that is acceptable. I can't figure it out.
Just big fun. Let's pretend we're raping you. Who wouldn't want to be part of that?
And pay for that as well. That's the other part. I'm going to pay you for that. On that note, this never dawned on me until right now, but I have some really good stories of working in a theme park for a couple of years. So at some point, maybe we do an episode, Jeff, where you tell court stories and I tell theme park stories. I bet we could have some fun with that one.
That'd be good.
All right. No. Story number two. You are batting.
No. Right now, I have to say, after we're done with this segment, I have to tell you about the court story of the day that happened today. It was unbelievable. Please continue, Barry.
Absolutely. Story number two. And Jeff, you are one for one at this point. Deputies have arrested a woman who claims she accidentally stabbed her husband to death after she slipped on dog poop. Rachel Fidanian, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, 38 years old, faces a charge of second-degree murder after a months-long investigation. A spokesman for the sheriff's office said Fidanian initially told deputies that she was cutting a pizza with a kitchen knife when her dog defecated on itself. She told deputies that she kept the knife in her hand as she tried to clean up the dog but slipped and fell into her husband. The suspect made a lot of excuses, but none of them made sense, the sheriff said. Our detectives did a thorough investigation. In the end, they determined this was an intentional act of domestic violence. Deputies said Fidanian stabbed her husband in the ribs, severing his pulmonary artery. Deputies also found Fidanian's initial version of events implausible, and he said she changed her story several times. The important part, deputies also did not find any feces or urine in the area described by Fidanian, the arrest report said. Oh, man. I mean, if you're going to kill someone, especially your spouse, I don't know. That seems like a pretty weak story. I slipped in dog shit as I was cutting a pizza.
I will disqualify myself, Barry, because I think not only do I know this happened in Florida, I think I saved this story to use next week.
Yeah, this is what's going to happen, because as I was doing research, I'm like, nope, Jeff used that one 3 weeks ago. He did this one. So you will find that. Yeah, this happened.
I will say, though, in the pantheon of our Florida man or not stories, next to the guy getting syphilis by licking the pole, the lady slipping on dog poop to kill her husband, maybe in the top three so far, Barry.
Alleged slipping.
Allegedly. You're absolutely
alleged,
right.
Alleged. Yeah. The guy really did get syphilis from licking a fucking stripper pole.
Which will
remain my favorite story of all time. This story we're discussing, Jeff, happened in the hometown of the unofficial mayor of Lakeland, Florida, Bubba Douglas. This was a Lakeland story.
The great Bubba Douglas.
The late great Bubba Douglas, actually. All right, moving on to my next story. So this one's a little sadder, but I still feel that it needs to be shared. I got to say, too, so these stories that we share every week, Jeff, these are legitimate stories. These are not stories that are on some fantasy website. These are in real newspapers, whether it's in, you know, I don't know if they're real, but I should say they're appearing in newspapers that are legitimate, whether it's the New York Post, the New York Daily News, the Miami Herald. These are appearing in that. But a story caught my eye this week, and I certainly wanted to share it here. A 32-year-old woman has been killed after an overdose on meth caused her to insert a gas pump nozzle into her anus and begin pumping gasoline. I'm not laughing at this woman's death. The woman, who is yet to be formally identified by authorities, is believed to have a record for multiple drug offenses. Officials who are involved in the investigation believe the latest incident was caused by the woman overdosing on meth. The victim has been known to abuse multiple substances, but her drug of choice is meth, said one investigator. According to witnesses who were horrified, the woman ran across several lanes of traffic to the gas station and grabbed a pump nozzle before pulling down her skirt. Horrified motorists looked on as the woman proceeded to shove the nozzle into her anus and begin pumping gas. "Oh, that feels good," she is said to have called out onto the onlookers, who were too shocked to attempt to even stop her. The woman continued to pump the gas until the cashier activated the emergency stop. She later collapsed onto the ground, and paramedics were soon on the scene to provide assistance. However, the gasoline had flooded the woman's internal organs after it was absorbed through her rectum. The gasoline entered her bloodstream and had a toxic effect, shutting down her key organ, said one doctor who tried in vain to treat the woman when she arrived at the hospital. Unfortunately, there was nothing we could do for her. So it's a very sad story. But at the same time, all I could figure is if you were driving by and you saw a woman shoving a gas pump into her ass, what are you thinking and what are you telling people later that day?
I got to tell you, if you're driving by and you see this, you've got the greatest story of your life. This is completely horrifying. Good Lord. Sticking a gas pump up your ass. What did she think was going to happen? You know, I mean, I can't imagine being so friggin' out of your mind stoned that you're like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to run across the street to the gas station. I'm going to stick that gas nozzle up my ass because hey, what the hell? I don't know what's going to happen. What do you think's going to fucking happen? Ay vey. No, I did not hear that. This can't be Florida because this one definitely would have been on the news down here.
Yeah, so this was Erie, Pennsylvania. But I'll tell you, as I'm reading this story, there's one thing. How did she pay for the gas? Did she swipe a credit card? Was it somebody else's deal? What was the, you know, how did the gas just start pumping that she could start pumping gas into her ass?
Now, obviously, she did not do the prepay. You know, she didn't go in and say, I'd like to have 5 gallons up my ass, please. You know, so... You know, you said that was Erie, Pennsylvania, Barry. Who's this guy, Gary?
The new guy, Gary.
Exactly. The new co-host.
It's Gary.
You said Erie.
Hey, it's Gary.
Yeah. Erie, Pennsylvania is where that story took place that we talked about. Oh, God, I'm drawing a blank now. The one with the pizza delivery guy.
Oh, my God, where they blew off his head.
Yes.
Show we watched on Netflix. You're 100% right.
Yes.
It's something in Erie. There's something in Erie. There.
Exactly. So there, and based on that documentary, we saw a lot of drug activity. So apparently, Erie, Pennsylvania, is not a place where you want to settle down with your family. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, definitely too. So I have two more stories. These will be a little lighter. Certainly, the next one's going to be a little lighter.
I don't think it can help but be.
There'll be no death in this one. So, Jeff, I don't know if you did hear this story, but police have arrested a man in connection with the sexual assault of a miniature horse and burglary at the same barn several weeks later. State police have arrested Adelio A. Guzman, 45 years old, in connection with the case. Officers say that on Tuesday, October 2nd, at approximately 9:37 p.m., they're very precise about the time, too, you know, at approximately 9:37 p.m., troopers were called to Pony Track Road for a report of a shooting. They found Guzman with gunshot wounds to his lower extremities. Police say Guzman had gone into the barn without permission and activated an alarm. The residents, a 73-year-old male and his 65-year-old wife, went to the barn and found Guzman. The male resident shot Guzman. During the investigation, police learned that Guzman, and that, this sets a record for saying his last name, by the way, because I didn't write this. Police learned that Guzman had previously entered onto the property in August and sexually molested the couple's miniature horse. Guzman turned himself in on Friday in connection with that case and was then charged with animal cruelty, attempted animal cruelty, and engaging in or trying to commit a sexual act involving an animal. He was also charged with burglary, criminal trespass, and criminal mischief. Holy shit.
So here's what I'm thinking. The 73-year-old man, you said it had happened there before? By the way...
He had gone, so according to the story, and I guess if I'm just going to consolidate, Guzman had gone there, either fucked the horse or the horse fucked him, and then he went back a couple of weeks later and he was going to try to steal something from the barn where the horse was. And then
the guy
activated an alarm and the guy shot him.
So the 73-year-old guy is probably, you know, he hears the alarm going off and he probably looks out there and goes, oh, honey, it's that horse fucker. He's back again. I'm going to grab my damn weapon. And I'm going to shoot him. Did he, you know, he probably shot him right in the balls or something to discourage any future activity. Again, this story, it sounds weird enough to be Florida, but having heard nothing about the horse whisperer, if you will.
Horse whisperer.
Yeah. What are you whispering to the horse? Hey,
sweet
girl. Hey,
yeah.
Girl. and the horse is going, I'm going to say not Florida.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's a state. It's my neighboring state. It's Delaware, which is the first state in the continental U.S. If I'm correct,
I think so
it is Delaware, where apparently if people don't have sex with horses, they have sex with miniature horses.
Is that what makes it weird? Not that it's just a horse, but he went for the miniature horse.
It makes it a little weird.
Pedophile kind
something.
Of animal.
There's, yeah. Only on Breaking Kayfabe. There are other podcasts out there. And I got to say, I've got messages this week where people say, I love what you guys do. It's not just wrestling. I like the fact. But I don't know if there's any other wrestling-related podcast out there where we've got a woman shoving a gas nozzle up her rectum and then a guy having sex with miniature horses, and we're discussing that. I think we're cornering the market on that.
Yeah, Scott Bowden. Sure. Scott Bowden does not talk about that on the Memphis show.
Oh,
John McAdams, Stick to Wrestling. You don't hear stories about guys nailing miniature horses. Only
no.
This kind of quality content is only on our show, Barry. So
yeah,
suck it, McAdam.
Exactly. That reminds me.
I have to tell you this in a roundabout way relates to that story you told. It's today's Barry, and we're looking for a sponsor. Courthouse story of the day. So I come back from court today, having got the rat out of my car engine block, and so one of the young ladies that works in my office is telling the story about something that happened in her courtroom. Now, she works in what is called the DV courtroom, the domestic violence unit. They deal only with domestic violence related cases. So apparently, Barry, today, there is a guy who is looking to have his bond either reduced or given the old what they call ROR, the release on your own recognizance, so you don't have to post any money. Okay, so the guy is charged with a domestic assault, and the allegation is, unlike some of the more horrifying ones, I'm certainly not making light of any sort of domestic violence because they do hear some horrifying. This guy was alleged to have turned a hose on his girlfriend and spraying her with the hose. And so the allegation is, the guy is telling it is, you know, the reason I turned the hose on her was that she didn't want to have sex with me. She'd rather have sex with our dog than have sex with me. Okay, so now the woman has apparently been outed as a dog fucker. I don't know, or at least alleged dog fucker. And so at this point, the woman who's sitting in the audience, victims' rights, of course, they have the right to be there at any appearance by the alleged defendant. The woman jumps up in open court and announces to everyone, nah, the reason I wouldn't fuck him wasn't because of the dog. It's because he's ugly. The motion for ROR was, in fact, granted. The gentleman got out of jail.
Wow.
Yeah. Just putting someone's business out.
Yeah. So there was a dog. God knows, and we're going to have to move on because I have one more story for you. But
have to get away from the animal
We really do. But there was a guy in Florida. I didn't use the story, and I guess the guy had been having sex. The guy and his wife had been having sex with the dog. It made all the newspapers this week, and it even made the New York Post, which is something that I call because they usually get really bizarre stories. But the dog, I guess, the dog is going to have to be euthanized because he's very aggressive around humans, and they don't think there's anything they can do to save this dog. So it's a very sad story. That's one reason I didn't bring this story up in Florida or not Florida, because the fact that the dog, you know, is sexually molested and then they have to put it to sleep because of some fucking asshole, you know, it's terrible. But Jeff, I do have one more story for you, and this one involves no animals, no gas nozzles, anything, but it does involve an irresponsible parent. And I think we've all seen irresponsible parenting. Again, you working in a courthouse, I've worked in theme parks and in restaurants. So we certainly have seen very irresponsible parenting. And this is a story that could only happen in Florida or not. Jeff, I present to you, a woman was arrested Tuesday after a sheriff's deputy saw her snort cocaine in the parent pickup line at a local middle school. A sheriff's deputy says he saw 39-year-old Christina Hester, who, by the way, had a Facebook page when I researched this story 48 hours ago, chopping a white powdery substance on her iPhone screen with a credit card while checking the school at about 3:50 p.m. He then saw her use a cut straw to snort the substance. The sheriff's deputy took Hester to his office until dismissal ended, then retrieved her purse and performed a field test of the substance, which tested positive for cocaine. The bag of coke weighed half a gram. The deputy then placed Miss Hester under arrest for possession and possession of drug paraphernalia. Jeff? This irresponsible parent.
This irresponsible parent has to absolutely be from Florida.
Yeah, it did. It's Jesus Christ. You don't miss one, Jeff. Yes, she's from Fort Myers, Florida. So just as a tip, if we have any listeners there, if your child goes to a local middle school, keep your eyes out for people in the pickup line to see what's going on with that action.
Yeah, yeah. And who's waiting to pick up the kids from seventh grade sitting there thinking, okay, little Bobby's he's about 5 minutes away. Let me snort a line here before, you know, give me a little bump, little tootski, you know, before so I can be up for his after-school homework. You know, who's thinking this?
Cocaine is still a thing, Jeff. You and I—we both lived through the '80s. I didn't know coke in 2018 was still a deal.
Well, per Florida statutes, Mr. Rose, it is still against the law here in the state of Florida. That is all I am going to say. Now, Barry, finally, almost an hour into this friggin' show where we've talked about bestiality a couple times, it's time to get some actual friggin' wrestling matches, and we've got a couple of good ones today. Because Barry, it is our last visit to the Sam Houston Coliseum in Houston, Texas. And we are fixing to make Kevin Orcutt very happy, because finally, after 2 months of Facebook messages, we're going to talk about Nick Bockwinkel versus Tito Santana. And we are also going to talk about Ken Patera versus Jimmy Snuka. Barry, you ready to go?
I am ready to go. And let me also say, let's make, since we're giving Kevin Orcutt credit
his
for this.
Brother because- Ken.
Yeah, Ken. Well, it's, you know, here's the odd thing. Apparently, he does have a twin brother, which I never knew. He's got a twin brother. Maybe his name is Ken. I'm not sure. But Kevin Orcutt actually posted both of these videos. I'm a little tongue-tied. It's the miniature horse molestation thing has thrown me for a loop. But Kevin Orcutt has been posting these on YouTube. So he's not just a fan, because he certainly recommended the Tito Santana-Nick Bockwinkel match to us for literally, as you said, 2 months. But he actually put it up on YouTube. But also to give a shout-out, because Kevin did, he messaged me and he said, are you guys going to discuss Don Leo Jonathan? And I said, I'm not really sure, because I think we've got a four-hour show coming up. But to that end, we do want to remember the passing of Don Leo Jonathan. He was 87 years old. He was one of those last living links to that golden era. And, you know, Jeff, you and I have talked about this numerous times. There is a roster of guys, and it's only about 20 or 30 names of guys who never worked the state of Florida. I cannot find one single match listing for Don Leo Jonathan.
Yeah, and, you know, when I first started getting into wrestling, And I would go out to the stores and buy the After magazines, that iconic issue that was discussed, on Jim Cornette's show this week, where you had the tail of the tape, the first meeting of Andre and Don Leo Jonathan in Montreal. And what a big the Battle of the Giants, I think, was the headline on the, I don't know if it was Inside Wrestling or The Wrestler. But, that's when I first got into it. So Don Leo Jonathan was always a name that I, just held on a pedestal, because that was one of the first names I read about. And but he was a guy that was a headliner for, a couple of decades. So, even the time that he wrestled Andre in the early 70s, he probably had to be in his early 40s then. And was an incredible athlete for his size, because he was, at the time he was probably about 6'6" by 300 pounds. And he probably was doing stuff that, something somebody would do today, and we don't want to think about it. But geez, back in the 60s, guys that size were not doing, the kind of moves that Don Leo Jonathan was doing, Barry.
No, and you're 100% right. And there's some footage. There's not a lot that's out there, but I remember years ago I got a copy of the WWWF handheld footage that was out there, and I still have it on DVD. And you know what? I should pull that out, because I haven't seen that in probably 5 to 10 years. But he was, and even then, that was probably early to mid-70s. I forget the exact year, but he was an impressive guy. And my assumption, and Kevin can certainly clue us in on the Facebook group, is I think he was a homesteader, because he's not a guy that worked a lot of territories. He never in Florida. I don't think he was much of an impact in Georgia, if he ever even worked a Georgia date. I don't think he spent much time in the South. So I think he was a guy primarily in the Northwest, possibly the Northeast, but a real talent. And I think it's our loss, our loss that we never got to see him. At the same time, kudos to Kevin. I think Kevin was responsible for hooking up Don Leo Jonathan with the great Brian Last.
Absolutely.
If I'm correct.
He definitely was.
That's huge, because, here's a guy in the last few months of his life that is a link to the history of professional wrestling. And Brian, Brian was fortunate enough to be able to have him on the show. So kudos. We remember you as well. Dick Slater, obviously, and Mike Graham on the 6th year anniversary of his passing. But at the same time, we have got a couple of humdingers. I'm stealing a line from Paul Bosch, because this Nick Bockwinkel, Tito Santana match, as well as the Ken Patera, Jimmy Snuka match, both are very good.
Yeah, and the last thing I will say about Don Leo Jonathan, you're right, he's a link to wrestling's bygone era. His father wrestled as Brother Jonathan, and I want to say he went back to the 30s. So, yeah, tremendous.
His uncle was a wrestler, and I want to say there was some sort of connection with the guy that wrote that book years ago, Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George. The guy's name was Joe Jairs that wrote that book, and they may have been related. I know they were Mormons or from Utah. There was some sort of connection there, which is a fantastic book if you've never read it. And maybe it's one of the first wrestling books that I ever recall, and it didn't really break kayfabe, but yeah, his family goes back, you're right, to the 1930s.
Sure. So, okay, so now it's time for us to go to the 20th of November, 1981, 2 out of 3 falls, Nick Bockwinkel, the AWA champion, faces off with Tito Santana, who's billed as being from Mission, Texas. I'd never heard him. Wasn't he always like, he was some Tukulo, Mexico or something like that when he was in the WWF. But here he's billed as being from Mission, Texas. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell me and Kevin Orcutt and the listeners what you thought of this match.
Absolutely, too. So this is a very good match to watch. It is, it's 2 out of 3 falls, which I guess all the main events in Houston were 2 out of 3 falls. And they do a nice job, because there's not really a lot of splicing on this match. Like, you're actually seeing the full match. To the best of my knowledge, we're seeing the full match here. So this match, it features the AWA World's Heavyweight Champion, who was Bockwinkel at the time. But if you remember, Paul Bosch had a situation with Harley Race, and I guess essentially left the NWA and recognized Bockwinkel as the true world's champion. So Bockwinkel, he was the world's champion. However, he's not defending the title. This is for Tito Santana's Gold Cup. That's a weird name, the Gold Cup, by the way, but, the Gold Cup is something that Tito had won, I guess, a few weeks earlier. There was a series of matches, and Bockwinkel is challenging Tito. It's smart booking because if Tito is able to defeat Bockwinkel, then obviously he becomes the number one contender locally. And what I find really interesting about this match is people forget how good Tito Santana was. Certainly by the time he got to the WWE, he was, you know, he certainly wasn't going to be the same guy that he was in Texas or even in Georgia, because Tito was a very, very good wrestler. And he was a guy that it's hard for me to find a flaw. I'm talking pre-WWF, WWE. There's hard for me to find a flaw in Tito's game. He's a good-looking guy. He's about 6'2". He's well-built. He can wrestle. He's smooth. He's fluid. I don't see a flaw there. And I think had he not gone to the WWE, maybe gone to Crockett or maybe spent more time in Georgia, I think Tito, and certainly, you know, financially, he probably made the right decision in going up to New York, but I feel he's a guy that would have been at the top of any territory because he was that good of a wrestler and that good of a worker. This match is very good, and what I got from this match is, this is a match very reminiscent of, let's say, Dory Funk Jr. versus Jack Briscoe. So you've got two guys who are wrestling. This is a wrestling match too. This is not a brawl, but there's some pretty stiff forearms. There's some punches thrown in, but they're always going to go back to the wrestling aspect of it. And I really like that. And that's something that, you know, growing up watching Jack and Jerry Briscoe, that was whenever they were in a wrestling match, not, you know, not wrestling a guy like, let's say, Killer Khan, but that match we reviewed last week against Danny Hodge, you know, they would do some really stiff, tight, snug stuff, and they may throw a punch or two, but then they get back to these really, really tight headlocks or leg locks. This is really similar in that. Now, we're seeing a very stellar wrestling match. Bockwinkel does an interview that takes place beforehand, and we've said it before. People will rave about it. My God, were his interviews great. This guy was something else. You know, we've discussed, we've debated. Bockwinkel is NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. You know, yeah, I see it. I got to admit, you know, I kind of wish he wasn't the world champion of just three or four states in the AWA. And that's not a knock on the AWA. Bockwinkel was a world-class talent. And, you know, I just imagine if we had got to see him, you know, at least challenging for the NWA World's title in the 1970s in a territory. Just a tremendous worker. But what a great interview. These guys are really so well matched. And it's not just, you know, that there's this Briscoe, Dory Funk Jr. like chemistry there. At the same time, they're similar physiques. They're similar in height. They're similar in physiques. They're just so well matched with each other. Bockwinkel wins the first fall in 25 minutes, and I absolutely love that. I like that they don't get down to the immediately down to a fall within the first 5 or 10 minutes. I like the fact that they stretch it out by, say, 25 minutes, you know? That to me is great. But Bockwinkel wins the first fall. Tito's going for a flying head scissors. He gets Bockwinkel once, goes for it a second time. Bockwinkel moves. Tito hits the ring turnbuckles, and Bock is able to pin him. Tito does come back. He hits him with a flying cross body block for the second fall. And then Tito wins the third fall with a flying press from outside the ring. And it's a really impressive. He literally catapults himself over the top rope and covers Bock. And I think the entire place was just shocked. It was one of those, like Terry Funk defeating Jack Briscoe for the NWA World's Heavyweight title. It was, I don't think people really expected that. And they sold it. The fans were up. The fans were losing their minds, which I thought was great. Paul Bosch is selling it. Tito's selling it. It's one of those moments. That ending, to me, was gold because it's one of those moments that I don't think anybody in the building, other than, you know, Paul Bosch and the guys in the ring, really expected. And it really comes off extremely well. So I like this match a lot. This is it's a wrestling match. It's not, you know, it's not a Bruiser Brody type of brawl. You know, we've certainly reviewed some amazing matches on here. But this is, it's a clinic. In a sense, it, when you watch it, it's got a clinic-like feel to it. And it's a real testament to how good Bockwinkel was and how good Tito was, that people don't, you know, people think of Tito as the matador, which it's completely not fair to the guy, because he was a top level worker in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah. I really, this match, I appreciate Kevin, finding this for us. Definitely would have been on my top 100 if I had seen it, because of a lot of reasons. You're right. First of all, it's a great match. The crowd, matches are so much better when you have the crowd as part of the story. And what's really good that I want to point out is how absolutely great Paul Bosch is in calling this match. You know, one of the things Barry and I have talked about, you know, and you hear it on other podcasts, your pantheon, your Mount Rushmore, if you will, Barry, of, you know, play-by-play wrestling announcers, you know, your Gordon Solie, your Jim Ross, your Lance Russell, and other people. And Paul Bosch is not a name that ever gets mentioned. And Paul Bosch, and the way – I'm going to compare him, the way that Bill Watts used to be on the Mid-South broadcast, he does such a good job of getting over every key aspect of the story that's being told in this, the involvement. He mentions that Tito Santana has brought his entire family to the Sam Houston Coliseum, that they traveled from out of town to be there to witness Tito Santana get his shot – in a non-title affair, Paul says, against the world champion. And that's, you know, just adds so much. Paul tells the interview, he tells the fans, bring your bell or your whistles, bring your signs. He's encouraging the fan involvement at the Sam Houston Coliseum, where you have, excuse me, a Latin wrestler who's getting a shot at the world champion, even if it is in a non-title match. And the Latin wrestler, to the Houston fan base, of course, there's of course a huge Latin base in Houston. And so they come out to support this young Latin wrestler, and he is over tremendously in the crowd, and his family's there. And Paul is just selling how the crowd is supporting him. And there's a great moment in this match where Tito has, I don't know, like an arm bar or something, and Nick is selling it. And Tito is just, you know, doing the whole pumping of his fist. And Paul says he's actually yelling to his family, and his family is giving him encouragement. And Paul's quote was, his family, who's come for this match, has told him to tear off his arm and hit him with the bloody stump. Wow, I thought that was tremendous that Paul said that. It's a little twisted, but it was really good stuff. And, a couple weeks before, they had this Gold Cup tournament that Tito had won. Apparently, Nick had been involved, because during the pre-match interview, Nick says, you know, they brought this kid in at the last minute. I hadn't prepped for him. That's why he won the tournament. Nobody knew he was going to be in it. Now he's got this Gold Cup. And so Tito, in a sense, is defending his Gold Cup that he won in the tournament, which, of course, sets up the whole match. So let me ask you something, Barry. As I was thinking about this, and I mentioned how much I love Bob Caudle. You know, and again, people talk about these great wrestling announcers, but you know who does not get enough love are the guys that I consider the homespun announcers, guys like Paul Bosch, guys like Boyd Pierce, guys like Bob Caudle, who aren't considered in the upper echelon pantheon of great wrestling announcers and play-by-play guys, but guys that were tremendous for their area and did a great job getting the product they were selling over to the fans.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of it too, and again, we have the benefit of looking at all of this in hindsight, so we can go back and we can analyze and we can pick out every little detail and we can say, okay, you know, and I've made my, I think, maybe the first episode about how terrible Ed Whalen was out in Calgary, though I suspect that if you lived in Calgary, for some people, he wasn't terrible because you were getting him on a weekly basis. But Paul Bosch is a guy, and I said this, and you've said it, and we both have agreed on this, that when we first heard him, we were kind of like, wow, not good. And then maybe after the third or fourth match, I was like, I really like this guy a lot. There is something very genuine and honest about Paul Bosch's commentary. I can't put my finger on it, but I can tell you, if I grew up with Paul Bosch and I watched the TV on a weekly basis and for 10 or 15 years and I listened to Paul Bosch, I would be very defensive of him, and I would say he's in the upper echelon, and he just might be.
Yeah, and, you know, he I was thinking about what makes, you know, compare a great announcer then to one of the announcers today. And, you know, let's be honest, what all these announcers are doing are pushing a product to you. But, you know, there are some announcers that push the product and you know that they're pushing the product and they're going a little bit overboard on, you know, something. But, you know, you know, somebody like Paul Bosch, he's pushing his product that he's promoting. But, you know, you're not sitting there going, yeah, he's pushing this product. He's so involved and he gets you so involved in the match that you don't realize that you're getting pushed this product. And that's a sign of somebody like Gordon or Lance or Jim Ross. That they did that you didn't realize you were, it's like they were car salesmen, but you didn't realize you were being sold a car. And that's what made them great. And that's why I love guys like Paul Bosch and Bob Caudle and Boyd Pierce, you know, and guys like that, because you were getting sold a product and you didn't realize it wasn't, I guess the better way of putting it, it wasn't heavy handed. They weren't beating you over the head with it. And unfortunately in today's product, that's a lot of what we see is the rather heavy handed approach. So we again thank Kevin Orcutt for nagging us for a couple of months to get this match talked about on our show. So, yeah, we want to recommend that we'll put a link up to the show, but just tremendous fun. And besides being a great match, the Paul Bosch commentary is just really excellent, Barry. Next, we are going to go to the 21st of December, 1979, Sam Houston Coliseum. Great matchup between two huge names, Barry. Ken Patera versus Jimmy Superfly Snuka. You had a chance to watch this. Tell us what you thought of this one. And by the way, can I just point out that apparently between like 1979 into the mid-80s, Houston was one hell of a wrestling town, Barry.
I think it always was. I think if you go back to the entire decade of the 70s, and then even go back to the 60s, even the 50s, but in the 60s, it was an absolute mecca for professional wrestling.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't mean to interrupt you. What I meant by saying is, I'm talking about what we have access to.
Gotcha.
You know, yeah. And because the stuff we have access to starts in the late 70s. And, you know, there's some stuff here that you watch this and you're like, wow, I didn't realize this stuff was this good. I interrupted your train of thought. Please continue.
Yeah. It was just what I was saying. I think Houston was always a great, great wrestling town. And we've discussed this also previously, but Friday nights back in the territory days, they were absolutely huge for professional wrestling. Obviously, Friday and Saturday night would always be, as you know, because you're going to get kids that aren't going to school, et cetera. But Friday night, you had two cities that were essentially one city territories, St. Louis and Houston. And then you also had Atlanta, which obviously was part of the Georgia circuit, but you had three major cities. And, you know, Dusty Rhodes, who was a part of Florida for years, was almost always somewhere else on a Friday night. You know, it was rare that he was ever in Tallahassee or Lauderdale, maybe once or twice per year, but you would find him every Friday in Atlanta or every Friday in Houston, something like that, because these cities were so huge. So I like this match a lot. This is another good match too. Patera comes out with JJ Dillon. So it was good to see JJ. And I want to say, again, this being a one territory town, I want to say that Patera and or Snuka may have either one or both were working in the Mid-Atlantic area at this time. And I'm not sure. I believe Snuka had been working as a heel. He certainly has the facial hair of a heel. He's got that kind of Harley Race mutton chop kind of deal going that Triple H had a few years back. He looks like a heel, and he's actually, there's parts of this match where he wrestles as a heel. I don't mean antagonizing the crowd or anything like that, but there's a point when he's got Patera on the ropes and he's choking him with the ropes like a heel would do. So I want to say that, you know, because these guys were probably just coming in just to work Houston, they were, you know, I think Snuka was working as a heel, maybe in the Mid-Atlantic area, but I'm not sure. You look at their physiques as well, and this is probably two of the best physiques of the 70s. Obviously, superstar Billy Graham, I think, will always win this competition. Steamboat at one point, Tony Atlas. But Snuka's physique, oh my God. The guy is just chiseled out of stone. Just incredible. And Patera, it's a different type of physique. He doesn't have the layer of fat that he had on him, the girth that he had on him when he was in the AWA. He's lost it. He's toned, but he's big. He looks like a power lifter, which he was. Patera was such a good heel. That's one, you know, as I started to watch this too, you know, it, to me, there's always this comparison of superstar Billy Graham versus Ken Patera. And Patera was, I think Patera was a better wrestler in the ring. I think superstar was flashier, had a different type of charisma. And Patera had his own charisma, but what superstar Billy Graham had is, you know, I don't think you can teach that. It's just, you know, you either have that or you don't. But Patera was a better wrestler, but a very good heel. He, the psychology, the understanding of how to be a heel, he definitely got. Danny McShane is the referee. Danny McShane, who was, I believe, 160 when this match took place, the oldest man in the history. If you think Bronco Lubitsch looks old or is slow, poor Danny McShane, who literally is hobbling around the ring. And I'll give Paul Bosch a lot of credit. He's obviously a loyalist because he's got Danny McShane in this match. I think it was Nick Kozak refereeing the other match, who was a top star in Houston. But Danny, you know, and Danny McShane too, is he's a bona fide wrestling legend and nothing but the ultimate respect for his accomplishments. But he's an elderly gentleman, and they're putting him in this match, and it's just very odd because he looks like he's been hobbled, and it didn't quite work to me. So Patera wins the first fall when he rolls through a cross body block from Snuka and then has his feet on the ropes for the pin. Danny McShane is right there, but he doesn't look up and he counts the three counts. So Patera does win the first fall. Snuka, however, comes back the second fall and he's like a house of fire. Right out of the gate, it's the chops, it's kicks, it's punches, it's everything. But he just goes for it. Snuka does something that I've never seen done before. And I know that you saw this, Jeff, because this to me, I sat there and I was like, what did I just see? And I had to go rewind it. I don't know if you rewind on YouTube. I went back and I rewatched it. But Patera's got Snuka in a full Nelson.
I actually wrote down.
How could you not, that, right?
He does a front. He does a front flip out of the full Nelson. It was pretty amazing.
I have never. I mean, you and I have been watching wrestling. So collectively, we've been watching wrestling for probably close to what, between 80 and 90 years.
Yeah.
You know, I have never seen that done before ever. He, as Jeff just said, Patera's got Snuka in a full Nelson, and Snuka flips him over. He front flips him over and breaks the hold. I sat there and I was going, what did I just see? I was speechless. I think that you have to see just to be able to believe it. But that was absolutely incredible. But Snuka does come back. He wins the second fall after rolling up Patera with a back bridge. It's a, he rolls him up. He rolls him into the ropes. He knocks down J.J. Dillon, schoolboys him in a sense, and then does a bridge, and is able to pin him. The third fall turns into a schmoz. They go outside the ring. Snuka lifts up Patera for a body slam, but they both fall over the top rope, which looks great, by the way. They brawl outside. It's a double COR, double count out of the ring. Patera actually rolls in, and Bosch thinks that Patera has won the match. And I actually thought Patera had won the match, but it turns out that the 10 or 20 count, whatever the count was, that both men were out. So this is a really good look. If you're a fan of Patera or Snuka, and I know that we've got people in our Facebook group that are listeners that are fans, this is one you're definitely going to want to see because Snuka looks great. Patera looks great. Everything works in this match as well. This is highly recommended also.
Yeah, a couple things. You know, I made a note, and you mentioned it, that Snuka is just absolutely shredded, you know, and just so cut in a way. And you mentioned him like very like a Ricky Steamboat, whereas of course Patera looks more like the power lifter. And you know, as I looked at Jimmy Snuka in 1979, the guy that came to mind, and I don't know how familiar you are with this guy, Barry, because I know you don't get as much of a chance to watch today's New Japan product. He reminds me of Kota Ibushi, and just that every move he does just seems so like, he seems so graceful and he just seems so ahead of everybody else, because, you know, I can watch a New Japan show and see Kenny Omega or the Young Bucks or Kazuchika Okada. And then I see Kota Ibushi, and he looks just like he's on a different level than those guys. And those are all great wrestlers, you know? I mean, these are guys that are top 10 in the world. But Kota Ibushi, when you watch one of his matches, the stuff he's doing, he's just so far ahead of those guys in my mind. And that's what Jimmy Snuka looked like. Jimmy Snuka in 1979, he looked like a guy who's like, he's doing shit that nobody else is doing, or he does it so much better because he's such an incredible athlete. I couldn't help noticing, and I mentioned this about the Houston stuff before, Barry. The crowd is just so interesting because everyone in the first couple of rows are wearing suits, and there's a little and there's a little boy who's also wearing a suit, and it's just it's such a difference, you know. Nobody's wearing t-shirts or shorts or anything.
So the little kid. So it's funny you say that because I actually made a note and I didn't talk about it. So there's in what Jeff is saying. If you look in the front row, there is literally four or five men all wearing suits and ties, but to the right, there's a little kid, I don't know, he's 10 years old, he's wearing a suit and a tie, and he is chewing the shit out of a piece of bubble gum. And yes. It is so funny to watch him, because he's chewing this so aggressively. I guess he's really wrapped up into this match, but that's, you know, in the 70s, that's really unusual. In Tampa, and in Miami as well, in the 60s, that was kind of the norm. Fans would come to the matches dressed up. And then by the 70s, that was definitely going away. We still had it in Miami in the 70s, but not as much. But when I saw that, I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, yeah, and it's good stuff. I will tell you the most disappointing aspect of this match, I was disappointed in the way the match ended with the kind of schmoz out in the outside the ring. But until that happened at the end, I was very entertained by this. I have to give a shout out to Paul Bosch on one thing. One of the guys, I don't know if it was Patera or Snook, is picking the other guy up in a body slam. And instead of calling it a body slam, Paul Bosch called it a crotch lift, which that kind of cracked me up. So yeah, Paul has his own special charm, as I mentioned, just the way that Boyd Pierce did and the way that Bob Caudle did. But this is a fun match to check out. And just look at Ken Patera, as you said, was such a great, you know, comparing Patera with Billy Graham. Billy Graham was a heel but he had that rap, and he was a heel that people liked. Patera was a guy that was a heel who was so obnoxious that people disliked him, you know, and it was impossible to really like Ken Patera. It was easy to like Billy Graham because he was so different from what you were seeing. And, you know, he had that rap and stuff like that. And Patera was just a guy that was an asshole. And, you know, and that's what I thought made Patera special, was he was so good at being an asshole back then. So those are the two matches that we would recommend that you check out. Both of them available. We will post a link on our Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, which, by the way, Barry, we are closing on that magic 1,000 number, and I can't wait till we do. And now it is time, Barry, to do a little top five. So I reached out to Mr. Rose last week, and I said, okay, what are we thinking? We had done the pre-1970 movies and some other stuff, and Barry said, it's time to get back to talk a little food. So, Barry, you ready to talk a little comfort food today, my man?
I am so excited about this, Jeff, that I have to clean up after myself. That's how excited I am. So,
well, I hate when you make a mess.
Yeah, but it happens. You know, at my age, too, it does happen. We want to thank our good friend Mark Hertweck. Mark is a foodie. Mark posts photos of his, as we do, of his lunches, of his dinners. It appears that Mark's wife is an excellent cook. She made something the other night, and I want to say it was short rib with a polenta. I love polenta, by the way, if it's cooked right. And this looked like it was cooked right. So we are grateful to Mark for coming up with this idea in the group. Comfort foods are interesting too. So I pulled up the actual definition of comfort food, Jeff, and comfort food is food that provides a nostalgic or sentimental value to someone and may be characterized by its high caloric nature, high carbohydrate level, or simple preparation. The nostalgia may be specific to an individual, or it may apply to a specific culture. So I that makes a lot of sense to me, because to me, comfort foods are foods that I would eat and I would feel good about it. Not in a healthy way, but just like, you know, look, there are times when I'm like, you know what, I'm going to go to McDonald's to get a French fries and a Coke because I love the McDonald's French fries. So Some examples of comfort food, Jeff: apple pie, biscuits and gravy, cake and cupcakes, casseroles, chicken fried steak, chicken and dumplings, burrito. I didn't put that in there, but somebody actually said burrito. I guess
donuts.
Well, my God, Jeff, do we love donuts? You mentioned donuts earlier, and I'm starving because I never eat dinner prior to the podcast, and you said donuts, and I'm like going, oh, my God. And I should say, our friend Alex of Curiosity Donuts has opened up a second location to all of our New Jersey listeners. If you are in the Princeton area, he has opened up in the Whole Foods of Princeton, New Jersey. So I have not made it down there yet, but I can guarantee you I will be seeing Alex as soon as tomorrow, because I got to go try these donuts. So, Jeff, are you ready to share your five favorite comfort foods? Because I know I am.
Well, I have to say, going into this, Barry and I have probably had, because of our busy schedules this week, have had the least amount of contact regarding our choices. So This could be great, or it could be a complete clusterfuck. I have no idea. Barry, why don't you give me your number five favorite comfort food?
Sure, and hopefully it's a combination of both, Jeff. It'll be a really great clusterfuck. My number five comes from the town of Lititz, Pennsylvania. So Lititz is, and most people have never heard of Lititz, it is directly next to Lancaster. And Lancaster, everybody's heard of. So Lancaster is where a lot of the Amish people are. There's a theme park there called Dutch Wonderland. And that's a lot of country. But I was in Lititz. I'm in Lititz, Lancaster. There's another area called Ephrata, which is right there, and I'm probably there once every 2 weeks. I do some traveling for my job. So I was in Lititz a week or two ago, and there's a restaurant there. It's called the Oregon. People in Oregon will hate me. It's Oregon, not Oregon. Oregon Dairy. And the Oregon Dairy is it's an Amish run, or at least it was at one time, an Amish run restaurant. They have a dairy bar. They make their own ice cream. They've got a buffet, but the restaurant is really good. If you want really good Amish homemade down home style cooking, this is the place to go. So I was there. I had an hour and a half to kill between appointments. I said, you know what? I'm going to go, because they do something there that is the best I've ever had. And what is that? It's their famous shepherd's pie. Have you ever had shepherd's pie?
I can honestly say I have not.
So let me describe it to you and tell me what you think. It's ground beef, mixed vegetables and gravy in a casserole, topped with mashed potatoes and then broiled. So it's meat. It's got like peas and carrots. It's got a layer of mashed potatoes. They broil it, and then they put gravy over it.
So let me just ask you, what is the difference between shepherd's pie and a pot pie? Is it like the mashed potatoes being in on top of the food?
Yeah, so it's and then there's no crust.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah, exactly. And that actually leads into my second favorite item, Jeff, which is the chicken pot pie.
You're jumping ahead now.
I am, but you're like Kreskin, but they do it. And what makes it so outstanding there is their flaky, buttery crust. But this shepherd's pie, and shepherd's pie to me, I've had good. I've had others that I'm like, yeah, it's so whatever. It's a little bit boring. They do something to this one. And I think the secret is it's not over broiled. And the gravy, it's a homemade gravy, which you can taste. They're really doing it. I go out of my way to get this shepherd's pie. Let me do give a shout out to the one dessert that I've gotten when I've been there, which I thought was also amazing. The baked whole apple dumpling served warm with homemade vanilla ice cream.
Okay. And what's the name of this place again, Barry?
It is called the Oregon Dairy, and it's in Lititz, PA. If you're ever in the Lancaster area, it's probably 15 minutes from Lancaster. It is worth the trip. It is on a secluded – it's on a farm, so it's not, you know, it's not a road that you're going to pass unless you're seeking it out, which is kind of cool as well.
Okay, my number five is garlic rolls, but – not just any garlic rolls. And, you know, Barry, you mentioned how different shepherd's pies were. Yeah, you go to five different Italian restaurants and you ask for garlic rolls, and you're going to get them five different ways. Some of them have a very light garlic basting. Some of them is just, you know, you've got a like a the garlic sauce, and plus like little crinkles of garlic on top. Some of them the roll is hard. Some of it's a softer. So the one I'm specifically referencing is a place here in Broward County in the suburb of Davie, Florida. It's called the Lovin' Oven. It's an Italian place. And their garlic rolls, what they do is they cut them up to where they're about the size of, I want to say, about a ping pong ball, about that size. And instead of getting like six garlic rolls, you get about 15 to 20 of these little mini garlic rolls. And as completely horrible as this probably sounds, it's just absolutely swimming in garlic butter. And it comes over, and what happens is the garlic butter soaks into the bread. So literally at some point when you bite into one of these garlic rolls, you're getting a mouthful of garlic butter too. And it's completely horrible for you. And oh my God, is it friggin' good, Barry.
Do you remember a place called Mario the Baker's?
Yes.
And yeah, so that's – so it, very, very similar is that you would get these garlic rolls, and they were known for it. Their pizza was good. Their pasta was good. But the garlic rolls put them in a different stratosphere. And you would get these garlic rolls, and they're swimming in this butter and the oil and the little chopped up bits of garlic. Oh, my God. It's so I have a ritual. Every time we record, when we're done – I order a large pepperoni pizza. I go pick it up and I eat it. I am sitting here now and I'm literally wiping the drool off of my face.
I am just going to say, by the way, as we're recording, that Mrs. Bowdern is in the living room with a pizza waiting for me. So I don't need to order. It's already there, Barry.
Yeah, it's. But I get you. Garlic rolls. And some people don't like them. And I forget where I was. I was with my family. So it had to be some – I know exactly. It was a place called Danny's Pizzeria in Bradenton, Florida, which we'll talk about at some point. They're just fantastic. And they have fantastic garlic rolls. And my son was like, yeah, I can take it or leave it. I've eaten like a dozen. Like I'm sitting like, I don't even need dinner any longer. Just give me garlic rolls. They're fantastic.
You know, you're another food that I find, you go to five different Italian restaurants and you'll get it served five different ways, and that's the pasta fazool soup. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, it literally means like a bean soup, and but you go to some places and there's no beans in it. And I'm like, it's pasta fazool. Why are there no beans? Or you'll get other ones where it's like they give you and it's almost like a stew. It's nothing but beans. And it's just, you know, it's weird. Garlic rolls and pasta fazool, different in every Italian restaurant you go to. Barry, number four.
Number four is a restaurant in New York City. I was there once. Let me take it back. I was there twice in one day. So this is about 6 or 7 months ago, a restaurant opened up in New York over the last 2 or 3 years called Jacob's Pickles. And yes, they specialize in pickles. They pickle anything, everything. They do normal pickles. They do spicy pickles, half sours, full sours. They pickle carrots. They pickle beets. But they do everything spectacular. But they also serve food that is, I guess, got a down-home southern kind of feel to it. So it's on 86th Street in Amsterdam for any of our New York listeners that are interested. But I went in and I tried two different things. So I went in and I tried something for lunch and I got the sausage gravy smothered chicken. And I was trying to toss up, do I get that or do I get the mushroom gravy smothered chicken? And I went with the sausage gravy smothered chicken. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was an 11. It was that good. Then I went back for dinner that night because we said that was such a good lunch. Let's go back and we'll go have dinner there. And I tried something different. And on a scale of 1 to 10, this was a 15. This was knock your socks off, call your mama, tell everybody you know. It was that good. It was a buttermilk fried chicken served on top of a biscuit drizzled with clover honey, then topped with their special house-made hot sour pickles. It's a thing of beauty when it comes to you. And then when you take one bite, it's the sweetness of this honey mixed with the spicy and the sour of the pickle. Then you've got this just fantastic buttermilk piece of fried chicken. Oh, my fucking God. Jacob's Pickles, 86th in Amsterdam. If you're anywhere near New York City, you've never been here, run. It is out of the five places I picked, it's the only place I picked out of New York because it was that fucking impressive.
Well, I thought for a minute there you were going to cut a Blackjack Mulligan promo. Call Mama from the kitchen. Tell her to come on in. We're going to tell them about the fried chicken there at Jacobs in New York.
I should have.
So, yes, you really should have. So my number four, I'm going with whether you go to McDonald's, which is best known for it in the fast food industry, or you go to a local establishment, the good French fry can certainly accentuate a meal. And here in the lovely town of Coral Springs, we have a place called Wings Plus. And my wife and I go there. We get wings and we like their wings. But the real reason we go is their French fries. And what they do is they, you know, I don't know what the name of the device is, Barry, but you put in the potato and you literally you twist it and it works almost like a corkscrew. So you get like a corkscrew, one big long French fry, and they flash fry it. And holy crap, is it good. Now, the worst part about it is when you get it right out of the cooker, it's amazing. But when it sits for a while, it starts to dry up a little bit. But yeah, Fresh out of the cooker, it is friggin' amazing. And I mentioned McDonald's. The one thing that I think we can agree on is in the fast food industry, fast food burger places, they have their fries are just top notch.
Yeah, so there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of secrets as to why their fries are top notch. It's not just a French fry going into oil. They do a lot. Beef tallow is involved. But McDonald's fries, when they are right out of the oil, and they've just been cooked and they're still hot and the salt is on them, it's the mix of salt and oil. Oh my God. But as I said, I'll go get a snack at McDonald's all the time and I never get the burgers, or rarely, but I'll get fries and a large Coke. And their Coke actually is a better Coke than most places, because their mix of the seltzer and their mix of the syrup to me is spot on. And McDonald's has a customized Coca-Cola. You can't get their version of Coke anywhere else. But I love it. But absolutely. And I know Wings Plus. There used to be one in Hollywood, Florida. I want to say it was on Hollywood Boulevard, right near the movie theater where the shopping mall is. And I used to go there on Monday nights when I didn't live too far away. I would go when I lived in Hallandale. I would go on Monday nights because they did karaoke every Monday night. And that fucking place was packed. I have so many good memories, and you're 100% right about those fries. And the wings were great, though. That was actually a spectacular wing. When those fries would come out, oh my God, were they good.
And, you know, speaking of karaoke, do you know who loves a good karaoke, Barry? Pat Patterson, who will be at the CWF Legends in Lutz, Florida. There's another plug for your event, Barry. So, Barry,
we're racking up the plugs on this one, and I got to say,
be disappointed in this episode, that's for sure.
Yeah, and this is the thing, you know, for guys like Aaron Crafton with a C, not a G, even though it is with a G, but we like to call him Crafton. But whether it's Aaron, Travis, Bruce Cohen, you know, or any of our other listeners, you will probably never get the opportunity to see Pat Patterson sing his version of My Way. And this is something that you can tell your grandkids about someday. So anyways, my number three, Jeff, we travel all the way to Charleston, South Carolina.
We have something that's going to be in common on this list, Mr. Rhodes. Go ahead.
Seriously?
I will reveal later on.
Is your restaurant Magnolia's?
No. So we got that going.
Thank God, right? However, is your item fried green tomatoes?
No, they're not.
Then we're safe. So anyways, there is a restaurant. So we'll start from the beginning. There's a restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. It's right off of Bay Street. It's called Magnolia's. It's a very high-end restaurant. And I ate there by chance some 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And whenever I am driving, if we can, we'll stop. So we did stop. We stopped on this last trip, which would have been, when was I in Florida? Over the summer. And on the way back, we'll actually go out of our way so we could stay and go have dinner at Magnolia's. And they do everything there. They do this duo of pork, Jeff. It's smoked pork belly with a grilled pork tenderloin and a potato fondue. They do shellfish over grits. It's sauteed shrimp, sea scallops, creamy white grits, and a lobster butter sauce topped with fried spinach. But the kicker there is the fried green tomatoes. I love fried green tomatoes. You can go into restaurants and literally 50% of the time you're going to walk away disappointed with the fried green tomato. The fried green tomatoes here, they come on a bed of cheddar grits. layered with fresh country ham, topped with a caramelized onion chutney and tomato butter. It is one bite. You sit there and you go, oh my fucking God, this is absolutely incredible. So we go out of our way. We'll drive hours. I shouldn't say hours, but we'll drive an hour each way out of our way, maybe a little bit more, just to go have dinner here because it's that good. And this is on a road trip from Florida to back up to Pennsylvania. That's how good the food is here. And calling it comfort food almost doesn't do it justice, but I got to tell you, you know you're eating something good when you take a bite and you close your eyes. It's almost like this euphoria just comes over you. That's what happens when I eat these fried green tomatoes.
My mother, of course, is a originally from the Palmetto State of South Carolina. And my mother, Mary Baudrin, hi, Mom, loves her some fried green tomatoes. So, yes, absolutely. I am aware that that is a staple of the, as they say, the dirty South.
The low country. Yes, sir.
Exactly. My number three, I'm going to go against the grain. I'm going to go with a chain restaurant here, Barry, because my wife's favorite restaurant to go to, a chain restaurant, I should say, is the Cheesecake Factory. And I am talking about the gumbo over white rice that they serve at the Cheesecake Factory. That is absolutely top notch. And if I offend any of our listeners who happen to be from Louisiana or the Gulf Coast, I apologize. But man, the gumbo over white rice at the Cheesecake Factory, you get your endoline sausage, your chicken, your shrimp, it's in a tomato sauce over the white rice. Holy cow, Barry. That is a staple of every evening when the Baudrins go to the Cheesecake Factory.
Yeah, I've actually had that gumbo. Yeah, Cheesecake Factory, some people love it, some people don't. But I do think the bad rap comes from a couple of things. One, that it is a chain. And B, it is the portions are huge. And I think some people look at that as a negative. And three, that the menu is in competition with the Bible and War and Peace for length.
Yeah, it's a huge menu, that's for sure.
It is. It's the biggest menu I've ever seen in a restaurant, ever, regardless of wherever. That being said, from a food perspective, I don't think I've ever truly been disappointed at a meal at the Cheesecake Factory.
No, so you're absolutely right. Neither have I.
Yeah, yeah. Service has gotten to me once or twice, but service is always a variable. But the food is good. That gumbo I've had, they do this Jamaican black pepper shrimp. I don't know if you or the wife of Everett, that I just think is spectacular. It's spicy as all, but really, really tasty. But I like the Cheesecake Factory. I don't get there often enough, but I actually don't have an issue with it at all.
And you know what? Now that you've told me, you reminded me of something. We in the past have discussed Anthony's pizza place, a chain that's also up there. Barry, did you know they have a new chicken wing? You know, not the one that's with the onions and baked. There is a new that's got a new it's not a new, I don't want to say breading. It's not a sauce. It's like the seasoning on it is different. And oh my God, I tried that. I said, can I just sample a couple? And they brought them out to me, brought me two. And I looked at the waitress and said, I should have ordered these chicken wings, because they're better than the ones that Anthony is famous for. So there's a little tidbit for Mr. Rose next time you go to Anthony's.
Oh, absolutely. Dude, let me ask you a question. Are these chicken wings sticking around, or is this a temporary item?
No, they said it's a new item to the menu.
Okay. Cause Anthony's over the last year, maybe year and a half, rolled out a bunch of new items and then got rid of them. And what they do is they put items out for a month or two to see what the feedback is and if people are buying it. And if they don't sell, they pull it back. You're not a salad guy, Jeff, which we have gone over, you know, multiple times.
I think we've
times.
Established that.
Slightly. But they were doing a grilled Caesar salad where they were taking a half a head of romaine lettuce, putting a little olive oil, throwing it on a charcoal grill, and then serving it with some fresh house-made Caesar dressing and those points that they do with that come with the chicken wings. It's basically like a pizza crust. And the Caesar, that was one of the best salads I ever had, but I guess it wasn't selling, so they got rid of it. But these wings do sound spectacular. I will absolutely try it. I am hoping to visit Anthony's this weekend as well.
Okay, your number two.
Number two, and let me say, my fingers are crossed that there's a great response to this comfort food, because I want to do a part two on this one.
All righty, sir.
Yeah, because I had a list of like 50 and I had to narrow it down. So my number two is, and I apologize, I said that that Jacob's Pickles was my only New York pick. Well, I lied. I blatantly out and out lied, and 5 minutes later I can correct that, because my number two also comes from New York. It is a place called Smack. And Smack is it's basically, it's a mac and cheese store. It's in the East Village on 1st Avenue and 12th Street. And my daughter, who is now 14, but we started taking her to New York. She was probably a year and a half. So her favorite food, even to this day, Chinese food and mac and cheese. And she actually said, I want to get mac and cheese. And we did some research and we said, this place looks like it's really good. And she was probably three or four when we did this. And we discovered this place in the East Village. And I got to admit, it's not only the best mac and cheese I've ever had, it's one of the best things I've ever had. And they do two things that blew me away. One was the buffalo chicken mac and cheese. It's cheddar and American cheeses with boneless chicken pieces and a buffalo wing sauce topped off with blue cheese crumbles. That's spectacular. The other thing that they do is they do the Smack Sampler, and it's got eight different types of mac and cheese in one skillet. What makes this so unique is every mac and cheese comes to you in a metal skillet. They put it in the metal skillet, they put it in their oven, and they bake it and then serve it to you in the skillet. So the skillet's piping hot. Touch it, you learn six, you know, you're going to lose six layers of skin. But at the same time, the flavor, because it's cooking in this skillet and it's cooking in the cheeses, it's just so spectacular. So this is a place, if you like mac and cheese, my mouth, I'm telling you, Jeff, I'm losing control. Thank God I'm in number two, because I am starving. I'm going to run out of the fucking house and I'm going to go get this pizza. But this mac and cheese is spectacular. And when I pulled this up online today or yesterday, the owner is looking to go public. And I was shocked, but she's got a business investor. She's looking for more investors. So she wants to take this national, apparently. This mac and cheese is that good. And I've eaten a lot of mac and cheese in my life. This is the best I've ever had.
Okay, my number two, here we are going to coincide with Mr. Rose's choice. I'm going to Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm going to a place called, the name of the restaurant is on Queen Street, and it's called 82 Queen Street. About 10 years ago, we, my family, my sister, my brother, and their our spouses went and joined our parents for a little family vacation up in Charleston. And we went to this restaurant, and it was the first time, Barry, I'd ever had the chance to have shrimp and grits made the Charleston way. Mm-hmm. And, oh, sweet Jesus, in the morning, shrimp and grits made the right way. If you are a child of the South, because I know people that are from the North, a lot of times they don't want to have anything to do with grits. They don't understand them. They don't get them. But shrimp on, and you know, I got to be honest, it's like chicken and waffles. When I first heard shrimp and grits, I thought to myself, what the hell kind of combination is shrimp and grits? That makes no sense at all. And I sat there at that table at 82 Queen Street that night, and I was like, oh my God, it was a religious experience, Barry. That's how good the shrimp and grits were at 82 Queen Street. And, you know, I've had shrimp and grits at other places that are good. They can be excellent at different places, but that night was the best shrimp and grits I've ever had in Charleston, South Carolina, 82 Queen Street. I believe it's still there.
Yeah. So it actually, I think it is. I think I saw it. So I believe it's still there. And I think it's one of those institutions of the city that's been there forever.
And it's like one of these restaurants that looks like when you walk into it, it's like you're walking into a house. It's like a two-story house. And so, yeah, the tables are in different rooms. So the waiters and waitresses are moving in different rooms in a house. And it's definitely a place you go to eat. And it's also a place you go to dine if you understand the differences in those two things. You know, you're not going to you're not going to a place to chow down. You're going to have the dining experience, but also you're getting incredible food, Barry.
Yeah, you absolutely are too. And you're 100% right about it being a house. And I think it's one of those old plantation style houses.
Exactly.
That are all throughout the South, if I recall correctly. Shrimp and grits is great. So if you're looking at a version of a comfort food, I think that certainly falls in the, but I will say, just to piggyback on that, the best shrimp and grits I've ever had was in Florence, South Carolina. This was also on a trip from Florida to Pennsylvania. We make that trip a couple times a year, and my wife researched the number one restaurant in Florence, South Carolina, and it was a fish camp. And they said the must go to item there was shrimp and grits. It was really affordable, unlike like Magnolia, where you know entrees are like $30. I think the shrimp and grits was like $12. It was, again, mind-blowingly good. It was one bite of the grits, and you said, wow. And grits, you're 100% right. It's polarizing. If you're from the North, you don't understand it. But at the same time, if grits are cooked, you know, correctly, especially if there's cheese involved, oh, my God, spectacular. So, yeah, so it's funny. Yes, yeah, South Carolina for me as well. But it would have been Florence. So, yeah. So are we to number one?
We are. Yep. And this grits reminds me of one of my favorite Michael Hayes quotes. I believe he said, I can't recall what it was he was talking about, but his line was, if that's not true, then grits ain't groceries and eggs ain't poultry. So I have no idea why it suddenly popped into my mind. But Michael Hayes throwing out a little food reference in one of his classic interviews. Okay, Barry, number one.
Number one. So when it came to number one, obviously, you know, this was going to be a tough call because I wasn't sure where to go. And then I was also, I had this subcategory in my mind of, okay, the best comfort food I ever had, maybe from a restaurant that's not around. And I said, I should save that. And I should only go with a restaurant that is current and still around. So I chose a restaurant in the Los Angeles area, in the Fairfax, right on Fairfax, and it's called Cantor's Deli. And I in my head, I'm going, okay, because I love deli. So, you know, am I going to choose Katz's Deli? But I got to admit, I chose Cantor's, and there's a reason that I chose Cantor's Deli. So Cantor's Deli has been there, I believe, for 70 or 80 years. And if you live in Los Angeles, if you've spent any amount of time in L.A., you have been to Cantor's Deli. It's an institution. It's, you know, Larry David goes there, which makes it okay with me, but everybody and their mother goes there. And Fairfax is such a cool area. So I was out in L.A. earlier this year. Was it this year? Last year? Actually, it was last year I was out in L.A. And I wasn't even hungry, and I still made the trip to Cantor's Deli because I had to get the one item that causes me to be 15 years old again, and that is their matzo ball soup. And I've had matzo ball soup my entire life, whether it's in, you know, the Rascal House on Collins Avenue in Sunny Isles or any of the delis. You know, South Florida used to have 20 delis, and they were all great, actually. But there aren't a whole lot of delis. It's a dying type of cuisine and a dying type of food. But I go to Cantor's, and I get the matzo ball soup, and I do that, again, that thing where I close my eyes, and the euphoria just kind of waves over my body. It's almost an out-of-body experience. And their matzo balls are light and fluffy. The chicken soup, you can actually taste the chicken in the broth. Always comes out steaming hot. They give you bread on the side, which is fantastic. But I have these memories of when I lived in L.A., and there were nights as a young adult, I was in my early 20s, and heavily inebriated or intoxicated, but not driving, mind you, because I was always extremely conscious of that. And the beauty of Cantor's was it was 24 hours a day. So we would stumble in there, me and the hooligans I hung out with, would stumble in 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning, and I would sit down with the bowl of matzo ball soup, and then I would get, you know, other items as well. But that matzo ball soup was so good, and I just always remembered it. So when I went out last year, long story short, or not really short at all, long story, it was as good as I remembered some 30 years earlier, and it was that good. And I was so taken with it. And there is a company now called Gold Belly. And Gold Belly will take your favorite food and ship it to you at a premium, of course. And Cantor's is on there. So when I saw that Cantor's is on there, I was like, wait a minute, you mean I can have the matzo ball soup delivered to my house? And it's done in, like, you know, the same day. It's done, I think, through FedEx. I forget who does it. And I was like, shit, I got to do this. And I don't know if it'll be the same if I'm not actually in the deli. But at the same time, it's a great memory. It's my favorite comfort food of all time. And those in L.A. will tell you, Rick Nathan will tell you Cantor's Deli is probably the place to go.
All righty. So Now it is time for my number one. I'll give you an honorable mention, Barry. When we go to the lovely Alpharetta, Georgia area, I will make sure, Barry, and drag you to the Midway Meal House for the homemade biscuits. I was thinking about putting the homemade biscuits on my top five. I will also mention, since we talked about Charleston, there's a place, it's a great breakfast joint called Hominy Grill. Did you ever make it to Hominy Grill while you were in Charleston, Barry?
No.
Yeah. That's a tremendous place. But my number one was never served in a restaurant. My number one comfort food is one that Barry mentioned, and it has a special story behind it. I was introduced to mac and cheese at the home of my Aunt Ruby Cook, my mom's older sister, and she's no longer with us. Aunt Ruby's recipe for mac and cheese was so well known and so sought after. Barry, I've never told you this story. At the funeral for my Aunt Ruby, every guest that attended her funeral got a copy of Ruby Cook's mac and cheese recipe.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And her mac and cheese was made, by God, the right way, where you have a layer of cheese on top that is baked so that it hardens. The macaroni is not saturated with cheese. There is a light dusting of cheese. And as Mrs. Bowdrin just pointed out to me, the mixture of the macaroni noodles, it's mixed with evaporated milk, which has a binding effect and just makes it so smooth and creamy. Barry, I am even willing, if the good folks on the Facebook page want, I will post Ruby Cook's mac and cheese recipe. That is how damn good, because I'll tell you, every Christmas, by God, in the Bowdrin house, we have ham and macaroni and cheese and green beans, because that's what I was raised to have every Christmas. And I look forward, because my wife got that recipe and she makes Aunt Ruby Cook's macaroni and cheese my number one comfort food, Barry.
Yeah, well, I definitely want you to post it, because I will absolutely make it. I will make it. I mean, all things considered, I'll make it the day you post it, and then I'll post in our Facebook group photos of the finished product, because I love to cook. It is one of, you know, I have too many hobbies, but the cooking is maybe one of my favorite hobbies, if not my favorite. So
it will change your life.
Please, bring it on.
All right, folks, we're about ready to wrap it up here now. I will tell you, folks, that this is the last show that we are taping before my daughter Kelly's wedding up in Alpharetta, Georgia, that Mr. Rose and I will both be attending. I look forward to seeing Barry. And then the week later, we're going to the CWF Legends Fan Fest. So it's going to be kind of a hectic couple of weeks for us here with the taping schedule. So we hope you will not mind that, and we will try to do our efforts. We're going to keep putting the shows out. Don't worry about that. But the recording schedules are going to be a little bit stunted. So, Barry, anything last before? And, you know, I think, Barry, you're right. Maybe not next week's show, but we, in fact, will do, depending on how it's received, a part two of our favorite comfort foods, because I had a lot of fun doing this.
Yeah, me too. And it's, you know, again, the beauty of this is the second we're done recording, I'm running out like a madman to get this pizza and shoving the entire pie in my face.
The pizza is waiting for me in the kitchen with the garlic rolls that my wife said she brought home.
Lucky bastard.
I don't have to go out and get it. I will encourage you all to follow me on the old Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll see you next week, folks.